Mazel tov. When Levine found out about my sister Betty, he invited her to the wedding. Mama started arguing, but he made that wave with his hand and said, "Don't be so old-fashioned. I want to meet one of these new women. Anyway, Celia wants her there." When Betty walked into the apartment a few nights later, my mother wouldn't even look in her direction. Betty grinned at me. Who knew little Addie would turn into such a spitfire? Going off on an adventure like that without telling anyone? Atta girl. I didn't really know Betty. What I remembered most about her was the fights she and Mama had about her not coming home right after work or about going out at night with friends. The funny thing is, except for the fact that she was younger and curvier, Betty was an exact copy of our mother. Same brown eyes, same wavy brown hair, and the same broad nose. They talked the same, too, as if they knew the answer to everything, shaking their heads up and down a lot, which made you nod back as if you agreed with them, even if you didn't. Betty was a big talker. She told us all about her job at Filene's and how she had moved up from wrapping packages to sales girl quicker than anyone could remember. "You see this skirt," Betty said. "I got it practically free. A lady brought it back to the store and said it was ripped when she bought it. I think she tore it herself, but the store has to pretend like the customer's always right, especially the ones who spend a lot of money. So that means us girls get some nice bargains." She asked Celia a lot of questions about this Levine and came right out and asked if she really wanted to take care of his two children and his house. Mama got mad. "Of course it's what she wants. It's what every woman wants." Celia said we shouldn't worry and that he was a fine man. Betty started coming over a lot, and she usually brought presents, tobacco for Papa, a scarf for Celia, stockings for me, chocolate drops for Mama. But no matter what she brought or how Celia tried to make nice, it always ended up with a fight. Mama would complain about America, how the apples had no taste and children didn't listen to their parents. Even the air was worse here. "People get sick from everyone breathing the same air. In our village, we had room at least. The air was clean." Sooner or later, Betty would smack the table and say, "Enough already. I remember what it was like over there, and the air smelled like cow shit, and the floor in the house was made of dirt. Can you imagine such a thing, Addie? Filthy and disgusting. In America, at least it's the 20th century. When they started fighting, Celia shriveled up like a plant without enough water. Sometimes I wondered if she was marrying Levine just to get away from the noise and the tension. Celia said she wanted to make her own wedding dress, so Levine bought her a beautiful piece of white satin. But a few days before the wedding, when it still wasn't done, Betty said she would help with the finishing and made Celia try it on. The dress was a plain shift that fell from her shoulders to her ankles with long sleeves and a flat collar. Betty threw a fit. "You can't wear that. Looks like a nightgown." Celia said it would be better when she attached the sash. "Then maybe you'll look like a shiny nurse," Betty said. "I'm going to buy you the fanciest veil I can find and some lace for the collar and around the hem. You're going to be a pretty bride or I'm not coming to this wedding." Celia giggled, and for a moment I saw them as children, the bossy big sister and the little sister who would follow her anywhere. Celia's wedding day was sunny and beautiful, so Mama had to spit three times to ward off the evil eye. "Rain is what brings luck," she said. Betty rolled her eyes and fussed with the veil, which had little pearls sewn all over and covered most of the dress. Made Celia look like a princess. Before we left the house, Betty took me aside and asked if Mama had explained to Celia what happens on the wedding night. I said, "Probably not." Betty groaned. "This isn't good, I'm telling you, Addie. Our Celia is not a strong person. We have to keep an eye on her, you and me." But now that Celia was leaving, I realized how much she had watched over me and had put herself between my mother and me. It was going to be awful without her. Celia took Papa's arm as we walked around the corner to the little storefront synagogue where Levine and his sons were waiting by the door. The boys looked miserable in new shoes and starched shirts, and the groom was blinking as if he had something in his eye. "Where's your family?" Mama said. Levine only had a few second cousins in America, but their children had gotten mumps, so the whole wedding party was just the eight of us, including his boys. The shul was in a store where they used to sell fish, and since we were there in August and it was hot, the smell came back. I'd only been there for high holiday services when it was crowded, especially in the back where the women sat, but that day you could hear an echo. It was so dark, it took a minute for my eyes to see the old men standing next to the table with the food. Papa said hello to each of them and asked about their wives and children. He prayed with these men before work every morning, so it was like his club. Mama didn't want them at the wedding. She called them schnorrers, moochers. But I was glad they were there. I thought they made things a little more cheerful. The rabbi came running in, apologized for being late. He had a long white beard with yellow tobacco stains around his mouth, but he had young eyes and clapped Papa and Levine on the back and said, "Mazel tov," like he meant it. He picked four men to hold the chuppah poles and called for Levine and Celia to stand with him under my father's prayer shawl, which was the canopy. The rabbi sang the blessings, Levine put a ring on Celia's finger, and they sipped from a cup of wine. After Levine stepped on a glass, the old men clapped and sang Mazel Tov. The whole thing was over in a few minutes. The rabbi shook hands with everyone, even Celia and the little boys, and left as fast as he came. "He has a funeral," Papa explained. We ate bread, herring, and honey cake, and the old man toasted the wedding couple three times with big glasses of Levine's whiskey. Celia stood beside her new husband and ate a few bites of cake, but when Jacob started whining and rubbing his eyes, she said maybe it was time to go. We walked with them to the end of the block and watched as they turned the corner. Betty was crying. Mama said, "What's the matter with her?" Papa patted Betty on the cheek. My grandmother used to say, "It isn't a wedding if nobody cries." The apartment was 100% sadder after Celia left. No one smiled at me when I walked in the door, and even though I had the bed to myself, I didn't sleep any better. My parents fought constantly. Mama went back to blaming Papa for the baby who died on the boat. "If you had waited with me until he was born, maybe he would still be alive." Then my father would say, "If we stayed and I was killed, then you and all your children would have died with the rest of your family from typhoid or from Cossacks. And if you'd let me take the other boy to the hospital here, he would still be alive." That was the first I'd heard about the baby who was born in America before me. He was small and weak from the beginning, but my mother wouldn't let him out of the house. "No one comes back alive from the hospital." He called her stupid. She called him a failure. Night after night, they blamed each other and cursed and wore each other out. Papa started going to shul right after supper. Mama muttered over her sewing until she had a headache. I stayed on my cot as much as I could, and when the days got shorter and it was too dark to read back there, I fell asleep early and got up before the sun. I didn't mind. That way I got out of the house before the bickering started again. This daughter of yours is a firecracker. Betty said she could get me a job at Filene's. The floorwalker has a little crush on me. I like the idea of getting out of the neighborhood and working in a department store. I wouldn't get dirty or ruin my hands and strain my eyes like I would in a factory if I could even get a job in one. But it turned out that Filene's wasn't hiring, and since I didn't know how to type or operate a switchboard, I went to all the tea rooms and sandwich shops I could walk to, but nobody was looking for waitresses. I didn't have any luck in the stores or movie houses either. One Sunday, when Betty, Levine, and Celia were visiting, Mama complained about how lazy I was. She thinks she's too good to get her hands dirty. Ethel Heilbron's daughter has the brains of a donkey, and she's making good money in a shoe factory. It's not Addie's fault, Mama, Celia said. Levine said she'll find something. I read in the newspapers about how a Jewish girl is running the whole library in East Boston. Jewish success stories were one of Levine's favorite topics. Look at me, I'm not even born here, and I own a shop with 20 workers. Just yesterday I went to buy buttons from Gleiberman, and he had a girl writing down the orders so he could sit on his tuchus like a big shot. And let me tell you, compared to me, Gleiberman is a small-time operator. Betty said, but if Gleiberman has a secretary, how does it look that you don't have a girl, too? Levine shrugged. He's spending a lot of money just to show off. It's not showing off, she said. It's professional. Besides, I read in a magazine you've got to spend money to make money. I heard that, too, he said. Betty winked at me. And it just so happens that you have the perfect girl right in front of you. Addie has good penmanship and an A in arithmetic. Tell him how you worked in that Settlement House lady's office. You were kind of a secretary there, weren't you? Suddenly, everyone was looking at me like I was a cow for sale. Levine slapped the table so hard that the cups rattled. Mr. Baum, he declared, this daughter of yours is a firecracker. She could start this week, Betty said. Now everyone looked at Levine, who rubbed his beard and glanced at Celia. What do you say, Mrs. Levine? She was bent over some mending and didn't answer, so he said it again, louder. Celia, would it make you happy if I hired Addie? When she realized he was talking to her, she looked up and said, yes? Of course, yes, Betty said, who was very proud of herself for coming up with the idea. She kept talking, and before Levine or I knew what had happened, she arranged for me to start the next day. When I showed up at H.L. Shirtwaist's at 7 o'clock the next morning, it took him a minute to remember what I was doing there. His factory was one big room on the second floor over a butcher's. There were maybe 12 sewing machines, a couple of pressing machines, some tables for cutting and finishing, all crowded together. And in those days, people didn't take that many baths, so you can imagine what it smelled like. Levine didn't have a real office, just a corner near one of the back windows where he had stacked some packing crates to make a separation. His desk was a door on top of more crates, and on that was a big mess of papers and envelopes and scraps of material. I picked up a receipt and remembered how the secretaries I met at Rockport Lodge talked about their bosses like they were little children who couldn't wipe their noses without help. I said, maybe I can straighten this up for you? Levine was blinking like he always did when he got nervous and said, just what I was thinking. By the end of the day, I had sorted everything into neat stacks and told him he needed boxes or a cabinet for the paper and ledger books with some new pencils. All you've got here are stubs. You aren't going to be saving me any money, Levine said, but I could tell he liked what I had done. Tomorrow, you'll go shopping. At the beginning, I was busy. I put away the old papers and made up a system for paying bills. I entered a whole year's business in a ledger, and I saw how Levine was doing, which was pretty good. He got rid of the door and bought a real desk that was so big we had to move the dividing crates back to make room for it. He was very proud of that desk, and after I polished it, you'd never know it was secondhand. On days when buyers or suppliers came in, I stood behind Levine with a new pad and a sharp pencil to write orders. How many shirt waists, in which sizes, by such and such a day, or how much thread in what colors to be delivered at such and such a price. The men were impressed that Levine could afford a full-time girl, even though I was his sister-in-law and probably working cheap. Actually, I knew from doing his books that I was getting paid almost as much as his best stitches, who were making some of the highest wages in the neighborhood. I also saw that he didn't fire people when they got sick, and that when one of the men had a baby, Levine gave him a whole day off for the bris and didn't even dock his pay. Celia's husband wasn't such a goneth after all. But after a few weeks, I didn't have enough to do, and there were days I could have screamed from boredom. Why is it you get more tired from sitting and doing nothing than from running around doing too much? But even a bad day at work was better than being at home. The best part of the week was going to the Saturday Club meetings, where I was a person who knew how to cook eggs over an open fire and play lawn tennis and do the turkey trot. My mother never let me out of the house on Saturday night without making a stink. Those women, they smile in your face, but behind your back, they're laughing at you and calling you a filthy yid. I didn't say anything back. We both knew that I was going to go no matter what. Levine was paying me good money, which meant she could buy chicken every week and didn't have to do as much piecework sewing at home. I kept enough to save for Rockport Lodge and even buy myself something now and then. The first thing I bought was a green felt cloche. You know what I'm talking about? A hat that's shaped like a bell, fits around your face. In my whole life, I never enjoyed buying anything more than that hat. It wasn't expensive, but it was stylish, and I felt like a movie star when I wore it. I loved that hat. My mother took one look and said it made me look like a meeskite. Ugly. That hurt my feelings and made me so mad I told her I wasn't going to talk to her unless she used English. And by the way, she knew enough to understand every piece of gossip she heard in the grocery store. I said it was for her own good. What if you had an emergency and I wasn't there? So then I'll be dead and you'll be sorry, she said. In Yiddish, of course. After that, when she suddenly needed me to run to the store or get my father at shul, always on a Saturday night, I shrugged and slammed the door on my way out. I was feeling my oats, as they used to say. What could she really do? Without what I earned, she would be back to sewing sheets 10 hours a day and eating potatoes every night. Money is power, right? Maybe I wouldn't be a wallflower after all. I'm not sure how much you want to know about your grandmother's love life. Not that I had so many boyfriends. My first kiss was that summer in Rockport when I was 16. There was a dance, and since there was a Coast Guard training camp in town, there were always more men than women. So all the Rockport Lodge girls knew they'd be dancing. I had never been to a dance, so Rose taught me the foxtrot and the waltz. She said I was a natural. If anyone asks you to do anything fancy, just say you're out of breath, and would he like to sit this one out with you? Of all the girls, I really did not have anything to wear, but Philomena tucked and basted one of Helen's dresses, so it looked like it had been made for me. Irene pomaded my hair and piled it on top of my head, and Gussie pinched my cheeks for color. When they were finished, I went to look at myself in the bathroom mirror. It was like one of those before and after pictures. When I looked in that mirror on the first day I was there, I saw a pale, scared girl with circles under her eyes, but here was a grown woman with a daisy behind her ear, smiling to beat the band. My brown hair was lighter from the sun, and with it pulled back and all fancied up, I could see that Celia wasn't the only Baum girl with an oval face and wide eyes. Maybe I wouldn't be a wallflower after all. The dance was in an empty barn that smelled of bleach and horses. There was a Victrola in the corner playing a waltz, but the town girls were all bunched up in one corner, whispering and staring at the Coast Guard cadets in their sharp white uniforms, who were leaning against the opposite wall, smoking cigarettes. Elegant, ain't it? Irene said. When we walked in, the cadets straightened up, and right away, Helen, Irene, and Philomena were out on the dance floor. Rose took me to the refreshment table, where a very tall cadet was standing near the punch bowl. "Allow me, ladies," he said, and filled us each a cup. He was so tall that I had to tilt my head up to look at him. His hair was as black as Philomena's, but very fine and parted on the side. His eyes were dark blue, almost purple, with the kind of long eyelashes girls dream about. He looked me over and said, "Green suits you." I was so nervous, I almost said, "You too." He asked if I liked to dance. Rose said, "Addie can really cut a rug. What about you?" "I'm not bad, if I say so myself. My mother taught me. By the way, I'm Harold George Weeks from Bath, Maine." Rose shook his hand. "I'm Rose Reardon, and this is Addie Baum. We're from Boston." "Nice to meet you, Miss Reardon. First time in Rockport, Miss Baum?" Just then the record changed, and he grabbed my hand. "The turkey trot is a snap. 4 steps in a box, and then you hop." Before I knew what was happening, we were on the dance floor, and he had his hand on my back. He leaned down and whispered, "Don't think." And the next second I was hopping and spinning around the room and having the time of my life. We were practically flying in circles, but somehow I wasn't getting dizzy. I was completely out of breath when the song ended, but Harold didn't let go when a foxtrot started playing. I was counting the steps in my head, but I kept losing track and stumbling. Harold pulled me closer to him. He smelled like lemons and leather and said, "You're thinking. Just follow me and you'll be fine." He really knew what he was doing, because the way he steered me around the floor made me look good. When that song ended, he bowed and strutted over to the other cadets, who shook his hand and slapped him on the back. My friends ran over to me, and Gussie said, "I thought you didn't know how to dance." Helen asked what his name was. Irene said he was the best-looking man in the room. But Philomena made a face. "He knows it, too." "How can you say that?" I said. "You didn't even talk to him." "I know a wolf when I see one." Rose pinched Philomena's cheek. "Oh, she's just jealous that he asked you instead of her." I danced with a few other cadets, but they were flat-footed and clumsy compared to Harold Weeks. I kept hoping he'd come back, but he was dancing with one of the local girls who knew how to tango and wore roll stockings and a lot of rouge. I'd given up on dancing with him again when he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Can you spare a waltz?" I didn't want to sound like I'd been dying for him to ask, so I said, "I could ask you the same question." "Jealous, huh?" I just smiled and tried to flirt like the other girls. I tilted my head to one side and opened my eyes really wide. Someone had told me that men like it when you let them talk about themselves, so I asked him why he joined the Coast Guard. I was supposed to take over from my father at the ironworks, but I hated the idea of building ships and never going to sea. "What did he say when you enlisted?" I asked. I didn't tell him.
"You mean you ran away?"
I was thrilled to think we had so much in common. He said, "I told my mother so she wouldn't worry. I'm a lot like her, and she has a mind of her own. You should have seen the looks in church when she walked in with her hair chopped off like Irene Castle." So much for having anything in common. When the song ended, I heard Miss Holbrook calling me and the other lodge girls off the dance floor. "I see I have to let you go," Harold said. He took my hand to his lips and said, "Meet me outside on the porch at midnight. I'll be waiting for you." And just like that, I had an assignation. I don't know how I knew that word, but I knew it meant something romantic. Maybe not so respectable, but completely thrilling. I told Philomena about it on the way back, but instead of being happy for me, she said, "Don't you dare. He thinks he can take advantage because you're so young." "Maybe he likes my eyes," I said. Maybe he thinks I'm a good listener.
You think he's coming over in the middle of the night to talk to you? I thought you were smarter than that.
We went back and forth. She told me he was a skirt chaser and to wake up, but I thought she was just being mean, or maybe Rose was right and she was jealous. Finally, she gave up.
If I can't talk you out of it, swear that you'll stay on the porch or else I will go out there with you.
After I promised not to leave the porch, Philomena didn't say another word to me all night. She just turned off the light and pulled the pillow over her head. I hated that she was mad at me, but Harold was so handsome, and no man had ever paid me that kind of attention. And when was I ever going to have another assignation?
I was lying on top of the bedspread, waiting for the first stroke of midnight, like Cinderella, except I had both my shoes on. I flew down those stairs and out the kitchen door, which they never locked. It was very dark, no moon or stars, and I didn't see Harold anywhere. I waited and worried and was starting to give up when I saw his white uniform moving through the orchard. He took my hands and kissed them really slowly, and not just on top, but on the palms, too. It made me shiver. But when he tried to pull me toward the trees, I sat down on the step and tucked my skirt around my legs.
Oh, so you are a good girl, he said, and sat down with his legs right against mine. Good girls don't usually dance like that.
I said, like what? Trying to act as if I'd had this kind of conversation a million times.
Free. Willing to go along and let loose. We were special together, Addie. Didn't you feel it? I could have gone on dancing all night with you.
He sounded so much like a character in a magazine story that I giggled.
What's so funny?
Nothing, I said. I guess I'm just not used to compliments.
You should be.
He put his arm around my waist. I leaned my head on his shoulder and imagined how romantic we must look. Then he turned my face up to his and kissed me on the mouth.
Your first time, he said.
Oh, no, I'm not a baby, you know.
Of course not, he said. I wouldn't do this to a baby. He kissed me again. He was as good a kisser as he was a dancer, and I followed him like I did with the foxtrot, without thinking. It was very exciting, and, well, let's just say that I didn't realize how far along things had gotten until I heard the church bell. That's when I sat up and said I should go inside.
Harold had his arm around my waist and said we should go out to the hammock in the orchard where we could look at the stars.
It's so beautiful, Addie, he whispered. I said no, that I had to go inside. When he didn't let go of me, I said it again.
A window upstairs opened and somebody coughed. Harold let go of me.
I shouldn't have come.
He sounded mad. I said, don't be mad.
Come with me and I won't be.
But I didn't move, and the coughing got louder. Harold stood up, lit a cigarette, and walked away.
No goodbye, nothing. It was awful.
Philomena pretended she was asleep when I got in bed, which was okay with me. I didn't want to talk about what had happened or how I was feeling, and boy, oh boy, was I feeling things. I didn't know if that meant I was a floozy or if I was in love. And what was Harold Weeks feeling? Maybe he was a wolf after all, or maybe I had done something wrong. Last thing I wanted to hear from Philomena was, I told you so, especially since I would have done anything to see him again. And I was miserable because I knew that was never going to happen.
We got a suffragette in the family.
Starting in September, Levine wouldn't stop talking about Thanksgiving.
The Americans say a prayer before they start eating, he said. What do you think, Mr. Baum?
By us, it's not a holiday, Papa said.
Why not? We live in America, so we should celebrate like Americans.
This week I filled out citizenship papers for Celia and me. My boys were born here, so they don't have to worry. Not Addie, either. But the rest of us, we have to apply. For what, Papa said? So they can find us easier to throw us out? Or put boys into the army?
For voting, said Levine.
Betty sniffed.
So why should I bother if they don't let me?
Levine clapped his hands.
We got a suffragette in the family. What do you think, Celia? Is Betty right? Should women vote like men? Celia?
Like always, Celia was mending clothes and not paying attention. She had dark circles under her eyes, and she'd gotten so thin that her clothes hung off her like they were pinned to a clothesline.
Levine said it again. What do you think about votes for women?
She looked lost, so I said, of course women should be able to vote. In Australia they vote, and in Denmark. After a year in the Saturday Club, I'd heard a lot of lectures about suffrage, and I was about to tell them all the states where women were already voting in America when Levine put his hands up.
I'm not fighting with you. Mr. Louis Brandeis says that in Palestine women should vote. That's good enough for me.
You are a modern man, Mr. L, said Betty.
I hope so, and I want you all to come and eat by us for Thanksgiving, like real Americans, with turkey and apple pie.
Celia did hear that.
You never said anything before. She looked terrified.
Maybe you should have given her a vote, I said.
It'll be fine, Celia, he said. Addie will help you. I'll give her the whole day off from work, with pay.
Mama made a face. She had tried to teach Celia to cook, but Celia burned everything she put on the stove and nicked her fingers whenever she picked up a knife. She couldn't boil water and chop carrots at the same time, and whenever Mama tried to correct her, she covered her face with a dishcloth.
Who would have thought a girl who sews with such golden hands would have trouble peeling a potato?
Celia's apartment was a wreck. Pots and dishes piled up in the kitchen, dust in the corners, and a sour smell of dirty clothes. Mama got so disgusted, she stopped going.
But I missed Celia and went to see her a lot, though I wasn't sure Celia was always glad to see me. Instead of hello, she would apologize for the mess and then try to clear the table so we could have tea. But first she had to wash the cups, and then she couldn't find the tea. She never seemed to finish anything, and she never sat down.
But the worst thing was how Levine's sons treated her. In the beginning, they were real monsters. Myron, who was 6, was just plain nasty when Celia talked to him, and Jacob, the 3-year-old, copied what his big brother did. Every time Celia gave the little one a bath, she got black and blue marks all over her arms. But no matter what they did, she wouldn't let anyone say a word against them.
Imagine how they must feel to lose their real mother. Who am I, a stranger?
Things got a little better after Levine gave Myron a smack for talking back to her, but better meant that they just ignored her, which wasn't hard to do since she was getting quieter all the time. The day after the big discussion about Thanksgiving, Levine was waiting for me at the door when I got to work.
Your sister says no turkey. No matter what I tell her, she won't have it in the house.
It would be a nice thing for the whole family. I want you to talk to her. The boys would be so disappointed. I thought Levine was the one who would be disappointed, but I understood how he felt. Every year in school, we learned about the pilgrims and how the Indians gave them turkey. I wanted to have Thanksgiving like the pictures in the newspaper, too, but not if it was going to make Celia miserable. I couldn't take his side against her. I told him it would be better if he asked Betty to argue for the turkey, figuring she'd be able to talk Levine out of the whole thing. She was always telling Celia to stand up for herself. But it turned out that Betty agreed with Levine.
It's not such a big thing, she said. He doesn't ask anything from us, and we're all better off because of him, you most of all. You have to help me talk Celia into it. Betty hadn't been to Celia's apartment for a while, and after being shocked at the mess, she took off her hat and gloves and started washing dishes like it was something she did all the time.
"You don't have to," said Celia.
"Of course not," Betty said. "Now go comb your hair."
After the sink was empty and the table was clean, Betty poured us tea.
"This is so nice," Celia said, and smiled like I hadn't seen in months.
Betty patted her hand.
"So what do I hear that you won't make your husband a turkey?"
Right away, the light went out of Celia's eyes.
"How can she cook a turkey in this place?" I said. "Do you see a pot big enough? Do you see an oven?"
"He's her husband," said Betty. "He pays the bills. He wants what he wants. I told Herman he could buy one of those cooked turkeys from the Italian butcher."
"Trafe meat in my house?" Celia whispered, like she didn't want God to hear.
She rubbed her hands up and down her cheeks.
"No, if it has to be, you can come here to eat, but chicken from the kosher butcher."
The tea went cold while Betty came up with one argument after another, but nothing changed Celia's mind. Finally, she said,
"Maybe you should go now. I have to make something to eat for him and the boys."
As soon as we got outside, I said, "Since when are you calling him Herman?"
"What are you mad about?" said Betty. "You're the one who told him to talk to me."
"He doesn't know what to do with her anymore. She's crying all the time, even in her sleep. So I told him how she didn't talk for a whole year when Papa brought us to America. At first she cried so much she would make herself throw up. She walked in her sleep, too. She's not a strong person, our Celia. She is afraid of everything."
Betty lowered her voice. "And I mean everything. Since the wedding night, she hasn't let him near her. I mean, in the bed. Can you imagine, all these months? He could divorce her for that."
I tried to think where Levine and Betty could have talked about such a thing. Across from each other in a restaurant where strangers could hear? In his office after I left? In Betty's room?
"I give him credit," Betty said. "He's doing the best with her. I told him if worst comes to worst, I can bring the turkey from the Italians. Celia doesn't have to eat it." But it never came to that. Somehow, Celia won the turkey argument, and Levine said he would have Thanksgiving chicken at 5 o'clock, which was a ridiculous hour since usually no one got off work until 6. But Levine said that was when regular Americans ate, so we would too. Papa made fun of the Goyish Simcha, the Gentile party, but the week before the holiday, he asked me to tell him the story about the pilgrims and the Indians. Mama decided she would make a tzimmis of mashed carrots, so at least there'll be something to eat. Betty said she would help Celia clean the apartment, and Papa went to the barber. I thought maybe it wouldn't be so bad after all. I thought I was in love. You remember my cadet, Harold Weeks? Well, I did see him again. I was on my way to Saturday Club when a man in a dark overcoat walked up to me and said, "Pretty hat on a pretty girl." When I realized who it was, all I could say was, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Aren't you glad to see me?" He'd gotten posted to Boston and looked me up. He remembered that I'd said something about my Saturday night meetings and did some snooping. Who knew you could be too happy to speak? He'd gone to all that trouble to find me when I was sure he'd forgotten all about me. It was like a dream. He said he wanted to take me to dinner, and I said yes. He talked as we walked, though I was practically running to keep up with those long legs of his. He told me he didn't like being in the Coast Guard anymore. He was bored all the time, and his shipmates were stupid. He didn't sleep at all when they were at sea, and the Boston barracks were disgusting. His uniform didn't fit, and he hadn't had a decent meal in weeks. We went to a famous restaurant that I'd never heard of, where everyone was eating things that didn't look like food to me. Clams, oysters, lobsters.
but I thought it all had to be good because everything was so elegant. The tables were set with heavy silverware and wine glasses, and the waiters wore big white aprons and moved around the room like they were on roller skates. The women were wearing beautiful dresses and gorgeous hats with big feathers. I thought I must look like a weed in a rose garden, but Harold didn't seem to mind. He was excited about the menu and ordered a huge amount of food and a whole bottle of wine. I tasted the lobster, which wasn't bad, but the clam was so slimy I swallowed half a glass of wine to wash the feeling out of my mouth. So then I was tipsy. Another first for me. I could hardly look at Harold eat the oysters. "You don't know what you're missing," he said. He was better looking than I remembered. His teeth were perfectly white, his fingernails were perfectly clean, and in the gaslight his eyes were blue-black. When he talked, I could feel his voice vibrate inside my head as if I was standing next to a big bell. When the waiter brought coffee, Harold said, "I haven't shut up all night, have I? What about you? Are you still working at a shop?" I couldn't remember what lie I'd told him. I was trying to think of a way to change the subject when I recognized a man sitting across the room. "See the old man by the potted plant," I said, "the one with the white beard who looks like he's going to fall asleep in his soup? I heard him give a lecture about Longfellow once." Harold took my hand under the table and moved his leg so it was touching mine. "Longfellow, huh? I didn't realize that you were such a highbrow." I forgot all about time until we walked outside and I asked how late it was. If I got home past 9:30, Mama might send my father out to find me, and if he went to the settlement house, Miss Chevalier would think I had used the club as an excuse to do something I shouldn't. I hated the thought of disappointing her, never mind what would happen at home. Harold said it wasn't even 9 o'clock and his curfew wasn't until 11. When I told him I had to start for home right away, he stopped smiling. After a meal like that, I figured we'd take a walk and have a little fun. I said I was sorry, but I couldn't be late. He took off up the street with his shoulders bunched up around his ears, and I really did have to run to catch up. Eventually, he slowed down, put his arm around me. "I never stopped thinking about you, Addie," he said. And when he leaned down to kiss me, I kissed him right back. "That's my girl," he said. I was his girl. He pulled me into a doorway and we kissed some more. I didn't have a telephone number to give him, so Harold and I decided to meet in front of the State House the next Saturday night. Keeping that secret made me feel like I was living inside a novel. The week seemed like it would never end. I kept bumping into things at work, and at home I was so touchy. Mama said she was going to give me an enema, which was her cure for everything. For our second date, Harold took me to a Charlie Chaplin picture. I loved Chaplin. But Harold seemed bored, and after a few minutes, he kissed me, and then, well, he got fresh. I told him to stop it. When we left the movie, he asked if I was afraid of him. I tried to make a joke out of it. "Should I be?" He chucked me under the chin. "What do you think?" It was still early, so we walked along Washington Street with all the other couples that were strolling along arm in arm. Harold said that on one of his walks around the city, he had found a wood carving that looked exactly like the ships his family built. "It's on the door of a bank, so nobody notices it," he said. "It's one of my favorite things in Boston. How about if I show it to my favorite Boston girl?" We left the crowds and walked to a street where all the big banks and lawyers' offices were. In the daytime, it was crowded and noisy, but at night, it was like a cemetery. I got a little nervous. Harold knew a lot about the decorations on the sides of the buildings, what they stood for and when they were made. Then he stopped. "Here we are." The door he wanted to show me was at the end of a long entryway where it was so dark I couldn't see the carving at all. Harold took my hand, ran it over the outlines of the boats and the water, and of course we started kissing. Like I said, Harold was really a good kisser, and by then I was really getting the hang of it, so I closed my eyes and stopped thinking. But then he started getting rough. He bit my ear and pawed at my chest, and when I tried to push him away, he pinned me against the wall. The next thing I knew, he had his leg between mine and was pumping against me hard with his mouth clamped over mine so I couldn't tell him to stop. I could hardly breathe. It didn't last long. When he pulled away, he kissed my cheeks and my forehead, sweet as could be. Then he sort of growled, "Now I bet you'd like me to say that I love you." Not very nice, is it? Not the kind of thing you tell your granddaughter. I don't think I ever told anyone about that particular experience. Who was I gonna tell? Philomena would say not to see him again, and I didn't want to hear that. I thought I was in love. I must have mentioned something about where I worked, because that's where Harold sent the letter. It started darling and was full of compliments. I was wonderful, I was smart, pretty, a good sport, and modern. He said he'd never met anyone like me, a real city girl, but not hard. There was even a little pressed flower in the envelope. He said he was going to Washington, D.C. for a few days, but I should pick a time and place for our next date, and he would be there or die trying. I thought that was very gallant. I wrote back for him to meet me at 9 o'clock in the morning on the State House steps on the Thursday that was Thanksgiving. I had the day off to help Celia, but I could still get to her house in plenty of time. And since it would be broad daylight, I wouldn't have to worry about him getting fresh. I went a few minutes early, but Harold was already there waiting for me with a rose. It was the first time I'd ever seen him in the daytime, and I was swept off my feet all over again. The brass buttons on his coat were gleaming, and the sun made his black hair shine. He had grown a little mustache, which made him look dashing and older. "You look so handsome," I said. He laughed. "For that, you're getting breakfast at the Parker House." I knew all about the Parker House. I asked if we could get some of their rolls. He said I was adorable. "I don't think they let you out unless you eat one of those things." There were oriental rugs and a big chandelier in the lobby, which was as quiet as a library. But the restaurant was completely different, loud and cloudy, with cigar smoke from tables full of men wearing good suits. I was the only woman in the room except for a white-haired lady who was drinking tea and reading a newspaper. A boy in a white jacket brought us coffee and a basket of those famous rolls, which were beautiful and warm. Harold told me about all the important people he had met in Washington and how pretty the monuments were. You have to see it sometime. When he finished his bacon and eggs, Harold put his hand on the inside of my knee and said, "Look at you, taking everything in with those big green eyes of yours. It's just like the night I met you." I thought to myself, now here's a girl who's on the lookout. You are free as a bird, Addie, the new woman. I tried to move my chair back and said, "How could you know all that about me from just a few dances?" "I know talent." He squeezed my thigh. "That was a real lucky night for me. But then, I'm a lucky man." Harold stopped the busboy from refilling my coffee cup and asked for the bill. "I've been assigned to the Coast Guard Commander's office. My father may have had a hand in that, but I don't care. It's a way out of that damn barrack." I told him that was wonderful. "Of course, it means I'll be moving to Washington," he said, as if he were talking about a change in the weather. "I'll ship out tomorrow." "Tomorrow?" I felt as if I'd been knocked down, like when the tide had pulled my feet out from under me at the beach. Miss Holbrook had said, "That's the undertow. A girl was dragged out to sea last month. They never found her body." Harold said, "I didn't want to tell you until everything was settled. And I've got another surprise for you." He put his arm around me and walked me to the elevator. "I got us a room so we can have a proper goodbye." That was the moment I couldn't fool myself anymore. Philomena had been right, and I had been an idiot. I said, "You think I'd go to a hotel room with you? Is that what you think of me?" A bell sounded, and an old man in a red cap opened the elevator grate. Harold leaned over me and whispered, "Don't give me that. You let me buy you fancy meals. You didn't squawk when I pawed you from one end to the other. You can't say I haven't been patient, so shut up and do as you're told." I tried to pull away from him, but he tightened his grip on my hand. "You're hurting me," I said, and not in a whisper. Harold looked around to see if anyone was listening and said, "Aw, sweetheart," to make it seem like we were having a lover's quarrel. "Now be a good girl." He pushed me into the elevator, but I said, "Let me go," loud enough so the elevator man said, "What's going on?" Harold had murder on his face. "Do you know what that room cost me, you little sheeny bitch?" When he reached for the grate, I bit him. I really sank my teeth into his hand. He howled and made a fist. I started screaming, "Don't hit me, don't hit me." When Harold saw the bellman coming toward us, he backed away from me, turned up the collar on his coat, and started to walk across the lobby. Not in any big hurry, as if he were taking a stroll through the park. I watched him, feeling like that drowned girl in the undertow. When the doorman opened the door for him and he disappeared, I realized that everyone was staring at me, and I took off in the opposite direction from the door. I was running without knowing where. I guess I was looking for another way out, but all I found was a stairway going down, so that's where I went and ended up in the basement, where I was almost hit in the face by a big tray loaded with cups and saucers. It stopped an inch from my nose, and I heard, "Jesus Christ!" It was the busboy who had poured my coffee. He put down the tray and asked what I was doing in the basement and what happened to my sailor. I started to cry. He was so nice. He said, "It's okay. I didn't think you looked like the type." I guess everyone in the restaurant thought I was a floozy, to put it nicely. I walked back to the North End as fast as I could. I kept my head down, thinking about how stupid I'd been. I like to think of myself as smarter than most girls, but I had talked myself into believing I was in love with a man who thought I was easy, who insulted me, who was ready to force me. So stupid. The thing is, I should have known what kind of man he was from when we were first on the dance floor. When Harold leaned down to tell me to meet him on the porch, I can't believe I'm saying this to you. He stuck his tongue in my ear. I was disgusted that anyone would do such a thing. But I was also thrilled, from one end to the other, if you know what I mean. But even after that night in the doorway, when I had bruises all over my back, even then I kept fooling myself. I'm still embarrassed and mad at myself, but after 70 years, I also feel sorry for the girl I used to be. She was awfully hard on herself.